I recollect it well, he said. The binding is of brown cordwain. All edges are gilt, and there are etchings by Gwinnock, hand-tinted. It is on the third shelf from the floor, and leans against a folio in green cloth. I believe it is Blathmaic's Lives of the 17 Megatherians. Largely to let him know I had not left him, though no doubt his sharp ears caught my footfalls behind him, I asked, What is it, sir?
The Earth and Sky Book, I mean.
Why, he said, don't you know better than to ask that question of a librarian? Our concern, young man, is with the books themselves, not with their contents.
I caught the amusement in his tone.
I think you know the contents of every book here, sir.
Hardly. But Wonders of Earth and Sky was a standard work 300 or 400 years ago. It relates most of the familiar legends of ancient times. To me, the most interesting is that of the historians, which tells of a time in which every legend could be traced to half-forgotten fact. You see the paradox, I assume? Did that legend itself exist at that time? And if not, how came it into existence?
Aren't there any great serpents, sir, or flying women?
Oh, yes,
Master Olton answered, stooping as he spoke.
But not in the legend of the historians.
Triumphantly, he held up a small volume bound in flaking leather.
Have a look at this, young man, and see if I've got the right one.
I had to set the candelabrum on the floor and crouch beside it. The book in my hands was so old and stiff and musty that it seemed impossible that it had been opened within the past century, but the title page confirmed the old man's boast. A subtitle announced, Being a collection from printed sources of universal secrets of such age that their meaning has become obscured of time.
Well, asked Master Olton, was I right or no?
I opened the book at random and read, By which means a picture might be graven with such skill that the whole of it, should it be destroyed, might be recreated from a small part, and that small part might be any part. I suppose it was the word graven that suggested to me the events I had witnessed on the night I had received my chrysos.
Master, I answered, you are phenomenal.
No, but I am seldom mistaken.
You of all men will excuse me when I tell you I tarried a moment to read a few lines of this book. Master, you know of the corpse-eaters, surely? I have heard it said that by devouring the flesh of the dead, together with a certain pharmacon, they are able to relive the lives of their victims.
It is unwise to know too much about these practices, the archivist murmured. But when I think of sharing the mind of a historian like Loman, or Hermes,
in his years of blindness, he must have forgotten how nakedly our faces can betray our deepest feelings. By the light of the candles, I saw his twisted in such an agony of desire that out of decency I turned away. His voice remained as calm as some solemn bell.
But from what I once read, you are correct, though I do not now recall that the book you hold treats of it.
Master, I said, I give you my word I would never suspect you of such a thing. But tell me this. Suppose two collaborate in the robbing of a grave, and one takes the right hand for his share, and the other the left. Does he who ate the right hand have but half the dead man's life, and the other the rest? And if so, what if a third were to come and devour a foot?
It's a pity you are a torturer,
Olton said.
You might have been a philosopher. No, as I understand this noxious matter, each has the entire life.
Then a man's whole life is in his right hand and in his left as well. Is it in each finger, too?
I believe each participant must consume more than a mouthful for the practice to be effective. But I suppose that in theory at least what you say is correct. The entire life is in each finger.
We were already walking back in the direction we had come. Since the aisle was too narrow for us to pass one another, I now carried the candelabrum before him, and a stranger seeing us would surely have thought I lighted his way.
But, Master, I said, how can that be? By the same argument, the life must reside in each joint of every finger, and surely that is impossible.
How big is a man's life?
Asked Olton.
I have no way of knowing, but isn't it larger than that?
You see it from the beginning, and anticipate much. I, recollecting it from its termination, know how little there has been. I suppose that is why the depraved creatures who devour the bodies of the dead seek more. Let me ask you this. Are you aware that a son often strikingly resembles his father?
I have heard it said, yes. And I believe it, I answered. I could not help thinking, as I did, of the parents I would never know.
Then it is possible you will agree, since each son may resemble his father, for a face to endure through many generations. That is, if the son resembles the father, and his son resembles him, and that son's son resembles him, then the fourth in line, the great-grandson, resembles his great-grandfather.
Yes, I said.
Yet the seed of all of them was contained in a dram of sticky fluid. If they did not come from there, from where did they come?
I could make no answer to that, and walked along in puzzlement until we reached the door through which I had entered this lowest level of the great library. Here we met Sibe carrying the other books mentioned in Master Gerlose's letter. I took them from him, bade goodbye to Master Alton, and very gratefully left the stifling atmosphere of the library stacks. To the upper levels of that place I returned several times, but I never again entered that tomb-like cellar, or ever wished to. One of the three volumes Sibe had brought was as large as the top of a small table, a cubit in width and a scant ell in height. From the arms impressed upon its Saphian cover, I supposed it to be the history of some old noble family. The others were much smaller. A green book, hardly larger than my hand and no thicker than my index finger, appeared to be a collection of devotions, full of enameled pictures of ascetic pantocrators and hypostases with black halos and gem-like robes. I stopped for a time to look at them, sharing a little forgotten garden full of winter sunshine with a dry fountain. Before I had so much as opened any of the other volumes, I felt the pressure of time that is perhaps the surest indication we have left childhood behind. I had already been 2 watches at least on a simple errand, and soon the light would fade. I gathered up the books and hurried along, though I did not know it, to meet my destiny, and eventually myself, in the Châtelaine Thicla.
Chapter 7. The Traitress. It was already time for me to carry their meals to the journeymen on duty in the oubliette. Drott was in charge of the first level, and I brought his last because I wanted to talk to him before I went up again. The truth was that my head was still swimming with thoughts engendered by my visit to the archivist, and I wanted to tell him about them. He was nowhere to be seen. I put his tray and the 4 books on his table and shouted for him. A moment later, I heard his answering call from a cell not far off. I ran there and looked through the grilled window set at eye level in the door. The client, a wasted-looking woman of middle age, was stretched on her cot. Drott leaned over her, and there was blood on the floor. He was too occupied to turn his head.
"Is that you, Severian?"
"Yes, I've got your supper and books for the Châtelaine Thicla. Can I do anything to help?"
"She'll be all right. Tore her dressings off and tried to bleed herself to death, but I got her in time. Leave my tray on my table, will you? And you might finish shoving their food at the rest for me, if you've got a moment."
I hesitated. Apprentices were not supposed to deal with those committed to the guild's care.
"Go ahead. All you have to do is poke the trays through the slots."
"I brought the books."
"Poke those through the slot, too."
For a moment more, I watched him as he bent over the livid woman on the cot. Then I turned away, found the undistributed trays, and began to do as he had asked. Most of the clients in the cells were still strong enough to rise and take the food as I passed it through. A few were not, and I left their trays outside their doors for Drott to carry in later. There were several aristocratic-looking women, but none who seemed likely to be the Châtelaine Thicla, a newly-come exultant who was, at least for the time being, to be treated with deference. As I should have guessed, she was in the last cell. It had been furnished with a carpet, in addition to the usual bed, chair, and small table. In place of the customary rags, she wore a white gown with wide sleeves. The ends of those sleeves and the hem of the skirt were sadly soiled now, but the gown still preserved an air of elegance as foreign to me as it was to the cell itself. When I first saw her, she was embroidering by the light of a candle brightened by a silver reflector. But she must have felt my eyes upon her. It would gratify me now to say there was no fear in her face, yet it would not be true. There was terror there, though controlled nearly to invisibility.
"It's all right," I said. "I've brought your food."
She nodded and thanked me, then rose and came to the door. She was taller even than I had expected, nearly too tall to stand upright in the cell. Her face, though it was triangular rather than heart-shaped, reminded me of the woman who had been with Vodalus in the necropolis. Perhaps it was her great violet eyes with their lids shaded with blue, and the black hair that, forming a V far down her forehead, suggested the hood of a cloak. Whatever the reason, I loved her at once. Loved her, at least, insofar as a stupid boy can love. But being only a stupid boy, I did not know it. Her white hand, cold, slightly damp, and impossibly narrow, touched mine as she took the tray from me. "That's ordinary food," I told her. "I think you can get some that's better if you ask." "You're not wearing a mask," she said. "Yours is the first human face I've seen here. I'm only an apprentice. I won't be masked until next year." She smiled, and I felt as I had when I had been in the atrium of time and had come inside to a warm room and food. She had narrow, very white teeth and a wide mouth. Her eyes, each as deep as the cistern beneath the bellkeep, shone when she smiled. "I'm sorry," I said. "I didn't hear you." The smile came again, and she tilted her lovely head to one side. "I told you how happy I was to see your face, and asked if you would bring my meals in the future. And what this was you brought me." "No, no, I won't be. Only today, because Drott is occupied." I tried to recall what her meal had been. She had put the tray on her little table, where I could not see its contents through the grill. I could not, though I nearly burst my brain with the effort. At last I said lamely, "You'd probably better eat it. But I think you can get better food if you ask Drott." "Why, I intend to eat it. People have always complimented me on my slender figure, but believe me, I eat like a dire wolf." She picked up the tray and held it out to me, as though she knew I would need every help in unraveling the mystery of its contents. "Those are leeks, Chatelaine," I said. "Those green things. The brown ones are lentils. And that's bread."
"Chatelaine, you needn't be so formal. You're my jailer, and can call me anything you choose."
There was merriment in the deep eyes now.
"I have no wish to insult you," I told her. "Would you rather I called you something else?"
"Call me Thekla. That's my name. Titles are for formal occasions, names for informal ones. And this is that or nothing. I suppose it will be very formal, though, when I receive my punishment."
"It is usually for exultants."
"There will be an exarch, I should think, if you will let him in. All in scarlet patches. Several others, too. Perhaps the Staros de Jano."
"Are you certain this is bread?" She poked it with one long finger, so white I thought for a moment that the bread might soil it.
"Yes," I said. "The Chatelaine has eaten bread before, surely?"
"Not like this."
She picked the meager slice up and tore it with her teeth quickly and cleanly.
"It isn't bad, though. You say they'll bring me better food if I ask for it?"
"I think so, Chatelaine."
"Thekla, I asked for books 2 days ago when I came, but I haven't got them."
"I have them," I told her. "Right here."
I ran back to Drott's table and got them and passed the smallest through the slot.
"Oh, wonderful. Are there others?"
"3 more."
The brown book went through the slot as well, but the other two, the green book and the folio volume with arms on its cover, were too wide.
"Drott will open your door later and give them to you," I said.
"Can't you? It's terrible to look through this and see them and not be able to touch them."
"I'm not even supposed to feed you. Drott should do it."
"But you did. Besides, you brought them. Weren't you supposed to give them to me?"
I could argue only weakly, knowing she was right in principle. The rule against apprentices working in the oubliette was intended to prevent escapes. And I knew that tall though she was, this slender woman could never overpower me, and that should she do so, she would have no chance of making her way out without being challenged. I went to the door of the cell where Drott still labored over the client who had tried to take her own life and returned with his keys. Standing before her with her own cell door closed and locked behind me, I found myself unable to speak. I put the books on her table beside the candle stand and her food pan and carafe of water. There was hardly room for them. When it was done, I stood waiting, knowing I should leave and yet unable to go.
"Won't you sit down?"
I sat on her bed, leaving her the chair.
"If this were my suite in a house absolute, I could offer you better comfort. Unfortunately, you never called while I was there."
I shook my head.
"Here I have no refreshment to offer you but this. Do you like lentils?"
I won't eat that, Chatelaine. I'll have my own supper soon, and there's hardly enough for you.
True. She picked up a leek, and then, as if she did not know what else to do with it, dropped it down her throat like a mountebank swallowing a viper.
What will you have?
Leeks and lentils, bread and mutton.
Ah, the torturers get mutton. That's the difference. What's your name, Master Torturer?
Severian. It won't help, Chatelaine. It won't make any difference. She smiled.
What won't?
Making friends with me. I couldn't give you your freedom. And I wouldn't. Not if I had no friend but you in all the world.
I didn't think you could, Severian.
Then why do you bother to talk to me?
She sighed, and all the gladness went out of her face, as the sunlight leaves the stone where a beggar seeks to warm himself. Who else have I to talk to, Severian? It may be that I will talk to you for a time, for a few days, or a few weeks, and die. I know what you're thinking. That if I were back in my suite, I would never spare a glance for you. But you're wrong. One can't talk to everyone because there are so many everyones. But the day before I was taken, I talked for some time with the man who held my mount. I spoke to him because I had to wait, you see. And then he said something that interested me.
You won't see me again. Drought will bring your food.
And not you. Ask him if he will let you do it. She took my hands in hers, and they were like ice.
I'll try, I said.
Do. Do try. Tell him I want better meals than this, and you to serve me. Wait, I'll ask him myself. To whom does he answer?
Master Gerlows.
I'll tell the other. Is it Drought? That I want to speak to him. You're right, they'll have to do it. The Autarch might release me. They don't know.
Her eyes flashed. I'll tell Drought you want to see him when he's not busy, I said, and stood up.
Wait. Aren't you going to ask me why I'm here?
I know why you're here, I said as I swung back the door.